Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Brandon Thurston from WrestleNomics is up next, and we're going to follow Brandon with John Pollock from Post Wrestling.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone.
But we can't ignore the math, okay? We can't ignore the data.
Go on Google Trends, type in your name, then type in mine. You're a straight line. I'm a pyramid.
I like the very direct question on that.
Television ratings, downward spiral. Buy rates plummeting.
The time is now to turn the math around.
It is Wednesday, June the 4th, and welcome to Pollock and Thurston. I am John Pollock alongside Brandon Thurston. We are here with you for the next hour where we are going to chat about 3 hours of SmackDown to infinity and beyond. We're going to be talking about not WWE cuts, but WWE, we are giving you your notice releases.
There were no cuts.
No cuts. None. Just, hey.
Drew Gulak wasn't cut. Get your language right.
Yeah. This is just see you later. You're off the books. And 14th and I. Suddenly entering the pro wrestling entertainment at large lexicon after Brandon doing some heavy-duty uncovering, getting to the intersection of Vince McMahon's next venture. All of that to come. Yes. How are you today, Brandon?
I'm fine. How are you?
I am doing well. Should we start off with our ChatGPT report
card? I've heard about this. You're previewing this to me. I've not seen it. You can tell me.
So I asked ChatGPT, are John Pollock and Brandon Thurston considered a positive or a negative to the business that they cover? Because my mentions would certainly lean towards the latter. We got the good and the bad. Which would you like first?
The bad is the only interesting part, but go ahead with the good first.
Okay. Well, the four pillars of our positive traits include legitimacy, accountability, trust, and education, including that they make wrestling fans smarter. I don't know if I will subscribe to that one. Introducing financial literacy, media rights knowledge, and understanding of long-term business trends. They elevate the coverage of pro wrestling beyond kayfabe and rumor, treating it like the billion-dollar industry that it is. But as we are always trying to be balanced, we do have some criticism. Some fans may see them as, quote, too serious or not fun in an entertainment-based business. Promotions may see their scrutiny as a threat, especially when negative trends such as declining ratings, revenue issues are spotlighted. In conclusion, John Pollock and Brandon Thurston are among the most important independent voices covering pro wrestling today. They complement each other well. Pollock brings editorial discipline and historical insight, while Thurston offers rigorous financial and data analysis. Neither is above critique, but both are far more of an asset than a liability to the wrestling industry and its audience. So weighing that scale of justice, we lean slightly towards more of a positive than the liabilities that we present to this chosen industry, Brandon.
A net positive for the industry. I guess we should be more fun, maybe, and maybe not focus on negative things. Maybe only focus on the positive things going forward.
Yeah, maybe we should wear lucha masks.
Why would we do that?
I'm trying to be as fun as we can on a live stream as we can.
Okay.
We can have some background music. We're open to ideas for fun. I mean, don't you and I scream fun? Who would not want to hang out with us at a party?
I don't care about that. I don't think fun is a very high priority for me. It is not a high priority for me. I think happiness is overrated, in fact.
You're looking for consistency. All right, everyone. That's our delve into ChatGPT today. As I don't vanity search myself, but I will. I am not above ChatGPTing myself to find out what the word at large is out there. Let's move on 14th and I. Vince McMahon, we have heard for months, transitioning away from the wrestling business, which he would claim he was never a part of. He was never in the wrestling business. But instead, he is now transitioning over, and this is his new company, which now has a name attached to it. And it's not just some random intersection. In fact, it has a historical significance. Brandon, you uncovered this. What did you find in some of these filings, and what is the significance of 14th and I?
Well, there are LLCs that he's registered, which he's registered LLCs called 14th and I, which the origin of that name is apparently an intersection in Washington, D.C., where the Capital Wrestling Corporation offices used to be, which is the predecessor company to WWE when it was under Vincent J. McMahon. He's also registered trademarks, and if this was going to be a wrestling company, I mean, when we see trademarks registered for wrestling companies that are undoubtedly for wrestling-related use, they do use the word wrestling in the purpose category. So, like, say, when AEW registered the AEW trademark for the first time, or when WWE registers nearly any of their trademarks, or when AEW registers nearly any of their trademarks, they do make it pretty clear that they want to use this trademark for the purposes of wrestling events or something like that. Usually we get the word wrestling in the purpose. That's not in here for the 14th and I trademarks, which he has applied for both with spaces between the ampersands and without spaces between the ampersands. And according to those filings, this is going to be a private equity company, and it will be also related to scripted entertainment, not the wrestling business. Even under Vince, these filings that WWE was doing were, you know, said that they were related to wrestling. So there's no indication here that he's starting a wrestling company. There's certainly no indication that he's going to buy back WWE, as some people have theorized or heard. That does not seem to have any truth to it. I think Vince has got multiple billions of dollars in net worth, but I don't think he has nearly enough to buy back TKO, nor is there any indication that TKO or Endeavor would ever consider such a thing.
No, I don't think that one is in the cards. The only other name that we know that is linked to 14th and I is Brad Blum, who formerly an executive at WWE. He was also one of the uncovered corporate officers named in the Janelle Grant amended complaint against Vince McMahon, John Laurinaitis, and WWE. But beyond that, we are not aware of anyone else that is necessarily associated with the company, but at least Brad Blum is. He is listed as the CEO of this company or president of this
company? He's got on his LinkedIn profile that he is the president of 14th and I. For some reassurance, his LinkedIn profile is verified, which means that he's probably shown his government ID to LinkedIn so that they can verify that this is really the Brad Blum, who's been a long time former W executive. When Vince was in and out of the company, Brad Blum was soon to follow him out and back in and then back out again. So it appears to be somebody very closely aligned with Vince McMahon in a pretty high level executive role. We know he was chief of staff. He had an EVP role, I believe. Janelle Grant describes various interactions she had with him. So he's been a long time W executive and apparently close to Vince. There might be a few other people you can find on LinkedIn. But how I confirmed this, to be clear, is this is not something that somebody told me in secret, but you can go on the Connecticut government website and search for businesses that are registered or that are registered in Connecticut. And this is a Delaware company because a lot of companies are incorporated in Delaware, but this has an office in Stamford. It's got the principal is Vincent McMahon. It's got a signature that looks like Vincent McMahon's signature on it. Reached out to Vince McMahon's representatives. They did not provide a comment, but we certainly don't have any denials here that this is Vince McMahon's company. And this is what he's going to do, apparently, or is already trying to do. And this business was registered back in September. So this is not necessarily even a new company that has just come into existence. We've just only finally learned about it just now. Probably because anybody probably could have figured this out 9 months ago or something like that if they wanted.
This was just some late night scrolling and coming across 14th and I.
I looked up Brad Blum on LinkedIn and I said, oh, he's working for a company here. What's this?
And lo and behold.
Because he was already reported, taking credit to PW Insider for reporting that Vince was getting into some sort of new business venture and that Brad Blum would be involved. So that all connects here.
So if you were looking at this, like number one, where this does differ from some of Vince McMahon's past outside ventures that he has gotten into, of course, I would say the most high profile recent one was when he formed Alpha Entertainment and relaunched the XFL. This was announced back in 2018 and then was a one and done season as it returned. But, you know, in this is not a Vince McMahon that has any attachment with WWE. On the flip side, Vince McMahon has more personal wealth than ever before that can certainly be, you know, the backbone of any kind of entity with
he's
the overall
liquidated quite a bit of it since the merger closed in 2023.
Yes. Like we know of the fact Vince McMahon has what we perceive to still be like some level of connection to Saudi Arabia and how instrumental he was in there as well. But over all of this, it is Vince McMahon, a post WWE career, as he's in the midst of multiple lawsuits, not just the Janelle Grant suit, but also the Ring Boy suit and, you know, attached with the shareholder lawsuit that's ongoing. Is any of that preventative of Vince McMahon moving forward with this type of a company and Vince McMahon being able to do business at a level that he wants out of this company?
That's the question, right? We don't know of any projects that are moving forward here. We don't really know anything beyond the name. It exists. It's got some trademark applications. It was started in September. The trademark applications were applied for, I believe, in August. But if there are any actual media or entertainment projects or investments, we don't know. That would suggest that I'm not necessarily sure that Vince would be like involved day to day, but it certainly seems like he's going to be the one funding it. And he's liquidated, I believe, well over $1 billion since the merger closed in September 2023. He still has plenty of W stock. He's still got about 4% of the total company, which is, depending on the day, which is another more than $1 billion that he could potentially liquidate. So, I mean, as far as we know, he doesn't have a title. I don't know how closely he's working on the company, or if it's Brad Blum that's primarily involved, and who knows?
Yeah, it's like it's one where I feel ultimately it's he can raise, doesn't even have to raise it. Like he has the capital behind him that can get him into a lot of various projects and businesses. And I really downplay the effect that any of these past years of allegations are going to prevent him from work. Like there might be a certain ceiling of companies that don't want to associate with Vince McMahon, but I think those are going to be the exceptions rather than the rule. It will ultimately come down to how aggressive this company is going to be and how much of a public face Vince McMahon will even be to this company. This is not something he is trying to get out in front of and attach himself to or do any kind of PR rehabilitation of his image. Like this has been, when Vince McMahon's name comes up, it is typically attached to Janelle Grant. And that is the public perception of Vince McMahon and has been for the majority of the last 3 years.
Yeah. I mean, we know that probably a major factor in what led Vince to leave the company in January 2024 after Janelle Grant filed her lawsuit was that Slim Jim, more about Slim Jim later, backed out as a sponsor of the Royal Rumble in 2024. Probably would have been the case if he had not resigned pretty quickly after that, that more sponsors would have followed and maybe there would have been more business partner pressure. But that just gives you a sense. And now that was a year and a half ago and maybe the heat has died down. I don't know. I mean, if you're looking at somebody who's got, you know, well over $1 billion liquidated within the last couple of years, you know, do you turn it down to because it's Vince and because of the news around Vince, or do you just say, all right, we'll accept it and maybe it won't be that big of a deal for us. Maybe it won't be that much of a deterrent to do the kind of business that we want to make movies or whatever it might be.
That's the soundbite right there. We make movies, pal.
Yeah.
WWE has informed several talents that their contracts are expiring, and when they do, they are not getting new ones. That included R-Truth, Carlito, and Valhalla. Sarah Rowe, who has been on maternity leave as well, which is kind of an added aspect to this whole thing that does not come across as putting a smile on that face. But there was certainly a lot of fan backlash toward this, mainly centered around R-Truth that at least extended to noticeable chance on both Raw and NXT this week. And it brings up, I think, a lot of topics that have sort of been percolating among WWE fans is just sort of these, just this growing understanding of TKO, which is, as the perception, rightly or wrongly, as a very, some would say ruthless, some would say efficiency, run company. But it is coupled with the fact that we are, you know, completely changing the experience of watching a WWE show that very much reflects that kind of ethos of TKO. You have, you know, I think like a pretty major move in just taking your biggest show of the year from a market of the country and yanking it out for pure profitable motives, rightly or wrongly, however you want to feel about that. And it's just this growing escalation. And it just felt like here is this character in R-Truth that was fairly beloved by the WWE audience. And that's the kind of thing that really does rally this emotion that we all have to come to grips to, that a Janelle Grant lawsuit is not going to inspire that level of emotion or emotional response or crowd chants, but take away one of our characters that we really enjoy, for purely making, you know, improving our margins, that does strike a chord with a larger amount of the fan base. That is something they can rally around. And it's also at a point, and I'm blabbering on here, we'll get Brandon's thoughts. It's at a time when I think the voice of the audience has never had less power behind it. Do you agree with that statement? Or do you feel like there is some influence the fans still do hold sway to, even in 2025 in a TKO world?
I guess they have somebody who's probably going to listen to them a little bit better than when Vince was around. But that being said, like, where does most of the revenue come from? In a sense, it's absolutely true to say that this isn't a wrestling company. This is a media licensing company that licenses its intellectual property and its rights to various business partners across the ecosystem. And
this is what it is. I mean, it's an eat what you kill world.
Yeah. As Mark Shapiro just said right there, who are the primary customers for WWE, for TKO overall, for that matter? Who are the primary customers? They're other major businesses.
And governments, and like, these are, you know, high above where...
AEW is no different. I mean, AEW is highly reliant on its major media partner, WBD. I'm surprised that there was as strong backlash as there was. I mean, how old is Ron Killings? 50-something?
52, I would have to double check, but over 50.
I'm sure he's a great guy, and clearly he's well liked. He's
53,
and he's been, you know, frequently featured on television. But it's unusual to have wrestlers on the main roster who are that old. So I was surprised that maybe it was just the timing. I know you guys talked about it. Maybe it was just the timing of the Saturday Night Main Event and him having this match with John Cena. That did a great rating, by the way. But I was surprised that the backlash was as strong as it is. Is this an accumulation of things after WrestleMania changed, after WrestleMania this year was not well received? I don't think this is, I don't know what I said say yesterday. This is a mild breeze, I think. And if the talent wanted to do something, you know, if they really wanted to change their situation, they probably would have done it a long time ago, when even more challenging circumstances had come their way in terms of COVID-19, in terms of the restrictions that they were facing with their use of things like Twitch and other video platforms a few years ago. The talent could, if they wanted to, organize at any time. And given the overwhelming reliance that WWE has on its media partners, on its live rights, if they had already organized, I think they would have a great deal of leverage in terms of, you know, in terms of putting pressure on management. Because I mean, imagine if talent were unionized or had a wrestlers association, and if they wanted to walk out or perform a work stoppage right before SmackDown, right before Raw. I mean, imagine, you know, Mark Shapiro having to call Netflix up, having to have a talk with Bella Bajaria or Ted Sarandos to explain, it's looking like we're not going to be able to deliver a show tonight. Having to call up NBC Universal and to tell them that looks like we're not going to be able to deliver SmackDown tonight. And what would that mean for their TV rights contracts? Because remember in COVID, you know, we were sure that, you know, everything's going to be fine. If they're going to do shows in empty buildings, but they're going to continue to produce new content. And that's not going to affect their TV deals. As long as they continue to produce new content, with fans or not, they're going to continue to get their payments. And they did. If they don't have talent, they're going to have a hard time producing new content. So that would put tremendous pressure, I think. But this, I have limited patience for discontent of talent these days in terms of they're not willing to do this. And I understand that there's a great deal of risk involved. And the people who would have the most power and leadership are at the top, who are taking care of the best. But there are a great number of protections, not just money, that talent could benefit from. And I understand that AEW has come along and has really ramped up the competition for talent and has likely ramped up the pay for talent. And that's good. What percentage of the overall revenue do you think it is? I bet it's well under 50%. I would bet it's closer to 10%, which if you compare that to other sports or maybe even comparing it to film, it's probably not very comparable. But there are a number of protections, not just health insurance, not just things that you can cover with paying more money, but you know, certain rights around early termination or certain rights around discrimination and ways that you can, if you feel like you're being politically retaliated against in the booking or something like that, you can go to the union and get some help. But that's not going to happen in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. It's one where it's like, it almost is it's Groundhog Day. Like these releases happen. Like it used to be like several times a year, they kind of quieted down and then the pandemic hits. And that was, to your point, that was a real tell on the WWE's side of how absolutely instrumental it was for them to get a program on the air every Monday, every Tuesday, every Friday in the midst of a global pandemic. And this talent was completely relied upon for them to fulfill that aspect of the deal. It's a time when we have talked about what leverage do talents have, and it's minuscule. But in that instance, they had a great amount of it. And without batting an eye, these, save for a couple talents, they all went into a workplace with a complete unknown about how much long-term damage this could do to my health. What am I even entering into? What are we doing here? There was no testing at the beginning point, but they went through with it. And when the response was a mass series of cuts involving some of those exact talents that stuck their neck out, that to me would end any kind of familial environment that I have some indebtedness to this company. But this has become every year we see these releases. And now there are multiple times per year, whether it is a contract being up, which I will say it's a better way out than it is the rug is yanked out from you midway through a contract and you have plotted your life around this 5-year deal that's over after year two. That said, when the recourse is, we will post about this person, we will put up images of him online, that is sort of the extent of it. It will last for 48 hours. In the rare case, you get chance on television, which we will see their longevity on top of it. And if I was a performer in the midst of the WWE and could even see this picture, would I have trust in my peers to join all together? I probably would not. I would probably feel that even if I was steadfast towards this, would everyone be in lockstep with me or just concerned about my next deal and I being that outlier that's going to suffer from this? And I think that paranoia breeds through and you are not going to get that level of trust among a locker room that would have power in numbers, to your point of the day of a pay-per-view. It's, hey, we are not going out there until we have some level of representation, some level of say in X, Y, and Z. We want no cut contracts. We want 1% of this Netflix deal. 1%.
But they're already being paid well. They're already being paid well, and AEW already exists and has ramped up everybody's pay, so they should. That's enough. Yes?
Paid well to whose definition? Like, this is just an arbitrary definition of what
they
well
should be
paid
thankful
means.
And grateful that they're being paid. They're probably, everybody on the main roster, I'm sure, is making six figures.
How much is your executive team making in comparison? Are they overpaid? Would they have those same complaints that they have of AEW, that those are overpaid? Like, how you are only as overpaid as the market dictates. You are overpaid. And when you see contemporaries, and I'm pulling up Programming Insider and seeing that SmackDown was the number one show on television, and I'm looking at other shows that all have mainly union representation, or I see our biggest competition is live sports, where these are unionized or associations that represent these athletes that are getting a far greater chunk of the pie, including television revenue, and we get 0% of this. Like, these are all questions that I feel like multiple times a year we have this discussion, but it is not going, there is a level of sympathy I always have when talent are let go. But if you truly have an issue with the system, it's one that if you believe TKO has to be the one, the leaders in this field that are going to stand up and say, you know what, you deserve more. That's total fiction that you're living in to believe that it's on the onus of TKO to voluntarily hand over more revenue when they're not being, there's no gun to their head being asked for that money. Like, this will ultimately be one where it would take the joining of a roster with its key talents to take a grand risk in all of this to make changes and actually form some level of association to get some kind of recognition. And we've talked about all the different options of whether they would qualify for SAG or as just like stunt performers on a weekly live television show. There's all of these aspects and we talk about them all over again, but it's like you and I have nothing to gain from this, but it's one where this is just this endless loop, and it just feels like this falls on the, well, this is how the business is run. This is part of the business. And it's just accepted as that without asking, well, why is this part of the business? These releases that occur every so often and talents that are ultimately beholden. And hey, where's our Slim Jim money?
Yeah, I would suggest that a lot of it has to do with just the subjective decision-making nature of pro wrestling. Like, at least with UFC, yes, there's subjective decision-making there, but there's at least some objective control you have in terms of you get an octagon and you either win or you lose, and it's usually a fair fight. Whereas with WWE, it's ultimately Paul Levesque's decision whether or not you're going to win the title. And so I think rocking the boat is much more dangerous. That's why we have probably, like, we're going to talk about UFC lawsuits, antitrust lawsuits brought by fighters against UFC and its parents. We don't have anything like that with WWE, certainly. This wasn't even relevant to this case, but just basically these contracts that all these talent are under are 90-day rolling contracts. That's not that much job security. Not only are they in all likelihood misclassified when they're actually being treated as employees because of the amount of control that WWE exerts over these workers, but they could be cut at any time, most of them at least, at WWE's will. So it's not great financial security. There's a good likelihood that you'll continue to be employed, but you've got 90 days ahead of you from today that you know you're going to get paid, but beyond that, you can't really be sure.
Well, on that front, when it comes to television exposure and what I can only assume is an equitable fee that WWE will be pocketing, SmackDown, it appears, will be staying in its 3-hour format for the foreseeable future.
Have you confirmed this yet?
This is where the balloons come down from the ceiling. this was first reported by WrestleVotes, and okay. WWE has not confirmed this yet, but at least on the USA Network schedule, it continues to be scheduled for 3 hours as over the next several weeks. And it sounds like as long as USA wants us to continue at 3 hours, it will. And WWE will continue to produce this scale of television. And I found it interesting to go back. It was interesting because Chris Zellner and David Bixenspan were just doing a look back at WWE's move from the USA Network to Viacom in 2000. And some of the coverage at that point was looking at how much of a blow would the loss of Raw. Remember, this is during the Attitude Era. They're at a big boom when it comes to television viewership in 99, 2000. Raw leaving the USA Network was still going to leave the USA Network as the number one network on cable at that time, ahead of Nick at Night and I think Nickelodeon, whatever it was. USA Network still would be number one without with losing Raw to just tell you like where WWE's influence was even at such a popularity high. Well, if we go back to November of 2024, I threw out December. And again, these quarters and numbers come both from Programming Insider and the great WrestleNomics. You should check out that outlet on a daily basis. So in November, this 10 to 11 p.m. hour was highlighted by scare tactics and hysteria, which is somehow that's colloquially what our show is sometimes referred to as well. Yes. Have you ever watched Scare Tactics or Hysteria? Did you ever stick around after SmackDown, Brandon? No, as someone that doesn't even watch SmackDown.
I think some of those Scare Tactics episodes ranked pretty highly on their night with the SmackDown lead-in. But as you can see here, it's a fraction of what SmackDown does, even in that third hour.
Yeah. Scare Tactics in November drew 405,000 viewers and a 0.11 in the demo following SmackDown. And then from 10:30 to 11, Hysteria would do 120,000 viewers and a 0.04. Just this past month of May, over five episodes of SmackDown, several of which faced significant playoff competition, 1,383,000 viewers over the three-hour period and a 0.36 in the demo. And as recently as February, when we last had the quarter hour or the hourly breakdowns, they were doing over 1.4 million viewers for that third hour and a 0.44. So, I mean, that just tells you it is like night and day comparison of what this third hour of SmackDown is to whatever programming they could slot into that 10 to 11 hour. And it was why, no matter what Paul Levesque stated or what was expected, when that end date came for these three-hour SmackDowns, how USA could stomach that pill and not ask themselves, what can we do to continue this three-hour version of SmackDown? Like, it's like, obviously, the value is there for the USA Network. Whatever changes this might require of their deal, whatever the incentive is for WWE, it's certainly of value for USA Network to continue this.
Yeah, and I think this chart, too, which is part of the reports that come out every week for every episode, I think this really illustrates it well. If people are watching in video, you can see the blue dots here are SmackDown. The red dots are Raw on the USA Network when it was on the USA Network. And there's some gray dots here that illustrate NXT. And the green dots are everything else. And nothing gets into the territory. This is the demo. But nothing gets into the territory of Raw or SmackDown. We've got some stuff back here from the summer of 2024, and that's all the Olympics. So that's a special occasion. And I'm sure and even that is below the level of Raw or SmackDown. I'm sure the ad rates are better, though, for the Olympics than Raw or SmackDown. That's why the Olympics bumped Raw out of the way a few times, despite having a lower demo rating. I'm sure the ad rates are just better to monetize. But just the great disparity that you see between everything else and SmackDown, it's multiples, and I'm sure whether or not the ad rates are better for other programming, the vast volume of viewership compared to everything else in the USA Network probably makes it worth it, and probably and then some for the USA Network. And I guess if you're USA Network, I mean, you want to drive more revenue, you want to drive, I mean, think of the ad impressions, the additional ad impressions they're going to be able to drive because they have a third hour. You know, they're increasing the duration of this show every week by a third. That's a lot more ad impressions that they can get satisfied that way. And what's the risk? Well, we're diluting the product perhaps, but Raw was diluted with 3 hours for decades and it's doing fine. It's a valuable property for Netflix. So I don't think it's prohibitive. It is a cost, but I don't think it's prohibitive.
Yeah. It might kill me. That might be a,
right.
A positive on their
it part might be a problem for podcasters this. Everywhere, but you know, I know that is about half the audience, but they're just gonna have to deal with it.
A lot of people that they also love people complaining that have to watch this as well. They love hearing people complain about this as well. They let me know that personally as well. No, I mean, it's I can't say this was any kind of surprising move at all. I guess the only question when you hear about this for the foreseeable future, I think you can end it with foreseeable. Like I think this was your demarcation point of having a decision of these 3 hour, was this move to 3 hours a positive one? It obviously was on USA's side. And I don't think WWE, things like viewer fatigue, anything like that, I don't think that even, I won't say does not at all register into their calculus, but I think it's so low down the priority list that I don't think it has any kind of meaningful tipping point in terms of their thought process on this. It's presumably, we'll say presumably, added revenue, and it's at basically no extra cost. It's just keeping your cameras rolling an extra hour in your fixed setting of the arena you're in.
Yeah, the question from an investor analyst point of view is, does this mean an increase over what we believe is $287 million average annual value for SmackDown on NBCU? Does that change your media revenues at all in any meaningful way?
I would think it would have to. Like, I can't imagine this is just, we're going to be good soldiers here and give you an extra hour.
Nice to our partner. I don't know. It could, you would think that you're not just upping it up for another hour. So this is 2012, right? When Raw went to 3 hours, do we know that they got an increase in payment at that time?
It was believed, yes, that they did get paid for that third hour. But I don't think we ever had like a concrete figure that was known, but that they did get, like, that was always the justification of it, was just that the
because that doesn't coincide right with the beginning of this July 2012, and that doesn't coincide with a new TV deal going into effect.
No, their deal didn't. They announced their next set of their next renewal was 2014. After that, would have been the first era of you know, like a year and a half of 3 hour Raws at that point.
Yeah,
as you extend this elsewhere, you know, AEW Tonight is going forth with a 4 hour broadcast, which, God help us all. You know, it does bring about the question. I feel very much so that WBD is experimenting a lot with Collision and its placement. And this will get into our next story, as, you know, WBD is at least at the table for these UFC negotiations, which if they get any slice of would take up Saturday nights. I think regardless of a UFC package, you're looking at Collision as potentially moving to a Thursday. And based on how these shows do, like, the idea of extending Dynamite, I don't think is out of the question either. When it comes to, you know, this programming that we are locked into for multiple years and trying all these different experiments with Collision. And I would say that if these 2 weeks of 4 hour shows, again, it comes down to what else would be in that 10 to midnight slot, and would an extra hour of Dynamite, do we make it worth AEW's while, even when you have had Tony Khan state as much that he feels 3 hours is too long? That does not mean it's going to preclude you from accepting an increase when this is a television revenue business.
Yeah, we have to look. We do have some examples of either Rampage or Collision in the past going on after Dynamite, and I think we found that, I think in those cases, I'd have to look, that those programs performed better than they did on their own, which makes sense. I mean, what's the best possible lead-in you could have for Collision? It's Dynamite, even if it's starting at 10 o'clock.
The greatest lead-in for Warzone was Raw, as they would remember, break them in between as well. They Raw would technically be two separate shows, just airing back-to-back. We've never seen the four-hour experiment.
No.
That will be something. I don't know what the audience will be by the end of 4 hours, but I don't think this is hardly going to do terrible either.
No, I don't think. Maybe this is something you see occasionally. I don't think we're gonna have a future where these shows really are back to back. I could see Collision definitely going to another night, especially if they're gonna get some UFC rights that need to go on Saturday.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
So John Orand, in his Puck newsletter, had an update on the ongoing UFC media rights negotiations. And he writes that the UFC is still a month and a half away from finalizing its next media rights deals, according to a bunch of sources. At least, how many do you think is a bunch of sources? Do you think that's more than four? How much is a bunch?
I would hope so.
I would say a bunch could be six. At least four big companies are in negotiations with TKO and its parent company for what will most likely end up being two packages. Renewal talks with ESPN appear to be the furthest along. Any ESPN deal would include linear TV rights, of course. If completed, this arrangement would almost certainly allow ESPN's planned direct-to-consumer service to carry UFC content, which currently resides on the ESPN Plus streaming service. Amazon Prime and Netflix are also in the room. Netflix already has a relationship with TKO through WWE Raw, and regular UFC fight cards would gel with its strategy of pursuing big live sports events like Christmas NFL games or Mike Tyson fights. That's pretty scary. He's putting in plural Mike Tyson fights. I don't hope for any more Mike Tyson fights. Amazon, I'm told, is most interested in UFC's pay-per-view business, which would reflect what Brandon Ross told us when he was on last time, that they have a real desire for pay-per-view content. The wild card in the negotiations is Warner Brothers Discovery, which has been picking up sports rights since losing out on the NBA last year. WBD would put UFC fights across its linear channels and HBO Max. It's not clear yet how many packages UFC will create. Most sources tell me it will be one or two. Three packages, the logic goes, will seem like too many, and a single package would inevitably go to a pure play streamer with its endless pockets, but potentially leave the sport underexposed. Read MLS on Apple
TV.
So, I mean, for this one, I think it is... I always hate to prognosticate because sometimes in these negotiations, someone emerges at the last minute and comes out of nowhere. But I cannot fathom whatever this renewal, not including ESPN, probably not any longer as the sole home of UFC. But I just cannot see some carve out for ESPN. And I think what's most interesting here, Brandon, is the pay-per-view content, which is the most desired content that I don't know how much appetite Netflix has for just weekly run-of-the-mill fight night cards. I think they want the most premium content. I think Amazon Prime, it's very clear here, they want that premium content. And for ESPN, I mean, I think they would be most open to taking like your weekly cards, but they also have this direct-to-consumer service to build, and I'm sure they want like a carve-out of like some of the pay-per-view business that is ultimately its most valuable here. But I mean, as you have always mentioned, it's the level of bidders that you have. And I think that does put the UFC in a good position here if all four of these outlets are at the table, even at a time when you do sense like some of UFC's kind of its buzz has been like there are similarities a lot between WWE fans and UFC fans at kind of the TKOification of these two entities. But when you look on paper, both companies are doing gangbuster business.
I would think ESPN bet. I would think UFC would be important to that business too. And I don't think these other companies have a betting sports betting business, but this does seem a lot different than the last pair of wrestling rights negotiations we heard about, which was WWE and AEW, where it didn't seem like there was a great variety of bidders. At least in AEW's case, we've heard rumors of Fox that have just seemed to have dissolved completely. Netflix was a surprise for WWE, and there were things floated like FX. Maybe Disney would be interested in WWE rights, and that doesn't seem to have driven up the price anyway. These weren't huge increases in monetary value for WWE in these TV deals, which suggests to me that there wasn't super interest from other bidders, even if you can tell a great story about Netflix. But this does sound like there are some real bidders, and I would expect a pretty strong increase in money compensation for UFC for this.
Yeah, the number that has been floated out there, perhaps strategically, is that they are seeking $1 billion a year in its rights fees. That would be a combination of its programming and
what they have now.
It would be, yes. Yeah, it would be more than double.
Yeah.
It would be a sizable increase for the UFC, which we will see if they fall. Like Formula One is in the same boat at the moment where it does not look as like ESPN has somewhat, you know, reined in the purse strings. If there is an argument for WBD and all of this, they are saving $2 billion a year by getting out of the NBA business. And the key is that they've maintained their carriage fees without the NBA so far. So that has ultimately, you know, at least in the short term, has proven to, you know, leave WBD not unscathed, because it is a major loss losing the NBA. But there are certainly silver linings to it, and they could be financially a viable player in this. But are they the outlet that TKO is seeking for its content when you do have pretty attractive options also bidding?
Yeah, according to my notes, it's $300 million AAV for the regular ESPN rights, and then it's another 200 for the ESPN Plus pay-per-view rights, which totals 500. So if they're looking for a billion AAV, that'd be 2x.
Staying on the UFC front, more antitrust lawsuits have been filed. Music to everyone's ears. So these would be the third and fourth antitrust suits filed against the UFC. The first one being the Kung Lee case that covered fighters from the end of 2010 through the end of June 2017. Then there was the Cajun Johnson-led case covering UFC fighters from July 1st of 2017 up to the present. So on May 23rd, Toronto resident himself, Misha Sirkunov, filing a antitrust suit against the UFC, and this is representing fighters in the Cajun Johnson class of fighters that have signed, they have signed waiver agreements and arbitration clauses in their contracts, which would prevent them from
arbitration clauses.
Yes. Tell me if this sounds familiar, that they will have to argue whether this should be, whether these arbitration clauses can be held up or not. So the argument from Sirkunov is that these should be thrown out. They go against both federal and Nevada law, and that if successful, then those fighters that sign these clauses, they would be able to be part of the Johnson case. And if there is a judgment or a settlement, they would reap in those rewards as well, which as of now, they would not. The other case, which is to me, a really interesting one, is led by Phil Davis, who was a former UFC fighter, went to Bellator, now fights for the PFL, and he is representing all non-UFC fighters since May the 29th of 2021 that are not part of either the Johnson or Sirkunov cases, and they aren't seeking any money. All they are looking for is injunctive relief, where this is arguing that fighters outside of the UFC have also been damaged by these practices by the UFC by having such a stranglehold on the top fighters and restricting their ability to have fights outside of the UFC with similar competitive talent. And they're seeking changes to the UFC contracts, including a provision that would allow all UFC fighters to be on 1 year annual contracts with the UFC, and then your deal would be up and you could assess if you want to resign, if you want to test free agency, but you would have 1 year periods where you are assigned to the UFC, and then you make that, that decision in your career. And as a caveat to this, John Nash, who does have a story on the Uncrowned site on Yahoo about this, he was also in the courtroom on Tuesday as they were having a hearing regarding these cases. And who has been assigned to oversee these cases? Judge Richard Boulware, the same man who was assigned to the previous Kung Lee and Cajun Johnson cases. So this is Richard Boulware's wheelhouse. And I think this man is a bane of the UFC's existence that has so far.
High school classmate of Dana White.
That is correct. Yeah, these two are not getting together at the high school reunion with the Fertittas. And the Kung Lee case has ended with a $375 million settlement. The Cajun Johnson suit is ongoing, and now you add these two. John Nash also noted in his story, the fact that Phil Davis's suit is not seeking monetary damages in all of this, it could speed up the process pretty dramatically. So that's something to watch as well. I don't know how likely any of these are. One is sort of just, it's the argument we've talked about in the Janelle Grant case and other ones, Brandon. It comes down to, are these arbitration and waiver clauses, can they be thrown out or not? It's going to come down to that interpretation. And then in the Phil Davis case, I think it gets very granular. I see the UFC fighting that one tooth and nail. Like, they do not want to disrupt their standard boilerplate contracts and the amount of control that having these fighters under multiple year deals has in terms of their favor, and how much of a change this would be for the industry if you could have all of your fighters. This would be like New Japan, where every January, pretty much all the contracts are up at the same time, and you could just test your free agency out there, and would give a lot of incentive to other promotions that if you could raise capital, you could at least go after some of the top fighters every year when their deals come up.
I want to look at the stock price. It doesn't seem like the stock price has reacted dramatically to this, right? So these are filed on the 23rd and the 29th, and it doesn't look like there have been huge moves in the stock in the last several days over the course of these lawsuits being filed. But anyway, if I'm understanding this right, the Serkinov suit is basically saying you as a reaction to these prior to the Johnson and the Lee cases, you've put arbitration clauses into everyone's contracts to try to make sure this never happens again. You've put clauses in the contracts to say you can't be part of a class action lawsuit. And Serkinov is coming forward to say, no, let's get rid of this and give me money because of the damage that you've done to me. And then the Davis case is basically, as you said, is not seeking any monetary compensation. It's just saying we want the contracts changed so that you can't have such control of the fighters. And
yeah.
And there's also some issues raised about fighters were often not given title matches until they would agree to resigning with the company.
Exactly. Like they, you know, there were certain situations where you would, and this, there were very few of them. Like BJ Penn comes to mind in 2004, where here he becomes a champion and then goes to fight in K1 afterwards. Like they would make sure your champion could not leave. And where this ties in, maybe a more recent example is Francis Ngannou was the UFC heavyweight champion, and he had a sunset clause built into his contract where no matter what, once the terms of this deal were fulfilled, he was a free agent, even if he was the heavyweight champion, which he was, and got to leave. And this was a big deal because this just did not happen, where a UFC heavyweight champion, the top heavyweight in the sport, got to leave as champion. But the problem was, he goes to the PFL, and his big fights have been in boxing. He's not had anything meaningful in the PFL. And that's what Davis is arguing, is that even if you slip through the cracks and get to leave the UFC, Francis Ngannou has no one to fight that would make it worth PFL's while to be able to reap in the benefit. Like, we're going to spend all this money on Francis Ngannou. We need big fights to bring to this guy, and we can't because the UFC has such a monopoly on the top fighters who cannot get out of these contracts. Even if we were willing to outbid the UFC, we can't even get to the table and negotiate with them. So there's damage being done to your Francis Ngannou's even outside of the UFC. Whether that's an argument that a judge is going to have sympathy for remains to be seen. But that is what the Phil Davis case is trying to argue about, how even people outside of the UFC are feeling the effects of UFC's control because they are less valuable if a promoter cannot put together top fighters in a division and only have access to a very small few that have a name value, are still in their primes as fighters, and can generate some level of revenue, but they need to be matched with other enticing matchups.
And is the notion that if everybody's just on a 1-year contract, everybody will have a lot more flexibility to have big fights outside of UFC?
That's it, is that if you are someone, like let's say you come in on the Ultimate Fighter deal and you sign like some 6-fight deal at a relatively low rate. Well, you can go through, win the Ultimate Fighter, and you have all these fights under this relatively minor deal. And as your contract is increasing, like a lot of fighters, like if they are escalating, the UFC will sometimes sit down and renegotiate a contract to make this fighter happy. But that's all on the discretion of the UFC. This would place more power in the fighter that might come in and roll through, you know, 3 fights in a year, and suddenly his value has increased so much. But rather than have 3 more years under this deal or X amount of fights that he still owes under these rather small amounts that he has agreed to initially when he was no one, he can reassess after a year, say, hey, my value has grown exponentially. I want to see what the interest is in the market for my services at this time.
It sounds like it would be disadvantageous to UFC, though.
Heavily disadvantaged. Like, this is a great amount of control that they have, that they control all of this. Like, they can hold you to a deal as long as they want, and they can also cut you after any fight. It's exactly like the WWE. Like, if R-Truth wanted out of his contract, and let's say there was a year left in it, WWE has no obligation to let you out of your deal. They'll say, no, you signed a deal. You're going to see the end of it. But the other way around, okay, your contract, let's say there was a year left on it, they could still let him go now. Like, all the power is on the promoter and not for the wrestler or fighter who has to honor the terms to a T. And that latitude is not provided for the promoter that can exit their contract with a 90-day no-compete. Or in the case of the UFC, they could just cut you outright. Like, they don't need cause to fire you.
But that's good for investors, though. It's good for UFC. It's good for the value of the company.
Well, these are not investors that are fighting. These fighters also have no stock in TKO either, to my knowledge. So that is not a relevant party that they are concerned for or arguing on their behalf. And it is worth noting, Eric Kramer is the same lawyer that is representing both Serkinov and Davis in these cases. He was also involved in the other antitrust cases. So that's a key legal figure that is behind these cases.
These lawsuits are definitely related. Same attorney. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. WWE and Slim Jim have extended an agreement, which, we had the Randy Savage era. Then WCW got to benefit from this when Randy Savage went to WCW in 1994. Then Slim Jim gets back into the WWE in the modern generation in a big way. Then January 2024 comes and they hit the pause button. And Vince McMahon gone. And Slim Jim, in a notorious PR gaffe, states that they have re-entered the Royal Rumble after Vince McMahon's dismissal, and the pause ended, and they have gone full-fledged ahead, and this will now culminate with branded Slim Jim folding tables on WWE programming, where WWE superstars will snap into a Slim Jim table during matches.
Can't wait. They're also going to get the center canvas sponsorship, right?
Which began on Monday.
This is how you you integrate brands into your content in new and innovative ways that create new opportunities for your partners, and you activate their marketing. I guess it's a creative idea, right? So I'm guessing that there's going to be like a Slim Jim logo on the table before somebody goes through the table.
Yeah,
right?
I saw some prototypes of this, and I didn't know if they were real or not. But from what I saw,
I guess the notion is that, of course, that, you know, somebody going through a table is going to be shared all over social media. It's this big high spot, and you're going to have Slim Jim branding all over the place.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to. You read this, and I think the general sentiment was people like vomiting in their mouth when they read this. It will be interesting to see when these are first brought out, if there's like any kind of a reaction from the audience. My sense is no. I think the audience, as much as there's complaints about the proliferation of this on-air promotion,
maybe people will finally stop chanting for tables.
That would be wonderful. Do you think they'll start chanting for Slim Jim tables?
Probably not. No.
No. Probably not either. Yeah. Well, there you go. That's the latest on the WWE front. How far away are we from Michael Cole and Pat McAfee calling Raw in prime bottles?
Inside of prime bottles?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a possibility. It'd be hard to sit in those, I guess.
Idea that should be considered.
Polestar. More data coming in. How about this from March the 10th? An episode of Raw. This featuring CM Punk against Seth Rollins in a cage match. 17,680 selling out the Garden with a gate of $3,287,000.
That's a huge gate.
The next night, NXT at the theater at MSG, 4,800 and a gate of over $424,000. I should add, the average ticket price for the Garden show on the Monday night, $186.
Yeah.
Average ticket price.
This is a $3 million gate? No, this is the theater. A $3.3 million gate, which would be, it's not as high as the two Raws that we talked about in Las Vegas and in London, which I believe are what? Something like $3.6 million. But this is, like a $3 million gate at an arena for a wrestling event is pretty unheard of until now.
This is, this period of, the lead up to WrestleMania, there are several gate figures that would be ahead of old WrestleMania gates that they were drawing. Like, these are insane numbers that they are attracting. April the 11th, this is SmackDown, a week out from WrestleMania in Seattle, did a $1.3 million gate with over 10,300 tickets sold. And then we do have a dynamite number from April the 2nd. This was in Peoria, Illinois, kind of just a standard weekly dynamite. 2,098 tickets sold, $106,000 gate.
Is that missing a number, though? That's only six digits?
Which, the gate?
I'm being mean.
Oh, sorry. $106,000 gate. Yeah. Quite the disparity here. Average ticket prices.
I know it's only Peoria. It's not Chicago. It's not a huge market. But I mean, like I said the other week, like not to incite tribalism, but just that's a huge disparity from the flagship show of AEW that's doing $100,000, which is a good amount of money. But then you've got in the Garden. Well, let's go to Seattle. Let's go to a smaller market, right? Doing $1.3 million at the gate. Now that's more than 10 times the dynamite gate in Peoria.
Is this something that like there is like I wouldn't argue like we see here. It's also listed if you're watching here. Like the dynamite tickets range from $25 to $90. Like you could certainly tout the fact that this is a way more affordable package to go.
Brand, yeah,
but I wouldn't even argue though that AEW is underpricing themselves. I think like this is the level that you're looking at for AEW. Like this is the beginning of April. I think they've made some strides in these last 2 months, but not to a degree where they're completely out of kind of this level that you can expect. It's like they are not, you know, running the doors down when it comes to their weekly television. We'll get into some of the numbers for their pay-per-views that are looking very strong for the next couple of months, but this is, you know, this is kind of a encapsulation of the grand disparity when it comes to selling tickets. Even in markets, like let's also add a Peoria. Peoria is not getting a WWE house show anymore, like 2-3 times a year. You know, there are markets AEW could go to, but I don't know if that necessarily is going to add up where markets that are no longer being served by WWE house shows are just going to become fans that now go to AEW if they hit those cities. It's a nice theory, but I don't know if that's going to be proven out. I think ultimately it comes down to what is your engagement in the AEW product, regardless of WWE servicing your market or not.
And it's going to be partly determined by the number of people who are in that metro area who could reasonably drive to the event. Yeah.
All right. And New Japan, April 11th at the Wind Trust Arena in Chicago. 1,647
that gate
paid.
Not right.
That gate the 200,000 figure?
It doesn't make sense, right? Because we have a it could be right. Could it? Go ahead and talk about it. I'll calculate it.
Okay. You calculate. Yeah, so this was not
that is right. There was one that we had that was
there was the Ontario, California one that came out, and it was an insane figure that was absolutely not in the realm of a New Japan show. They had them listed at like something like an $800,000 gate that just didn't add up from any stretch.
Okay.
So or else New Japan would be
rare US. Yeah. Even this rare US New Japan show with I guess like a comparable volume of 1,600 doing about twice of what the Peoria show did. I wish we probably do further back in time, but not to dwell on this Peoria one, because I think that's kind of typical for AEW TV tapings to be somewhere around 100,000, maybe a little higher.
And just mentioning those AEW pay-per-views coming up. So all in, and these numbers coming from WrestleTix. All in Texas is now past 16,000 for Globe Life Field in Arlington. Forbidden Door at the O2 Arena in London on August 24th is at 11,800. And All Out in Toronto is now at 7,400 tickets out. So that is, those are the three upcoming pay-per-views. I would imagine All Out should get to 10,000, you would think, overall. Are you on the fence about All Out? Is Brandon Thurston considering getting All Out of the U.S. that night?
I'm not strongly considering it, but we'll see.
Okay.
Are you going?
Maybe. To be determined at this point.
Okay.
Nick Khan sold some stock. What does this mean?
He sold some stock worth about $4.5 million. He still has plenty of stock. This was part of a stock trading plan. So this is not unexpected. Just to say that he did sell 28,557 shares, which, as you can see here, have an aggregate market value of 4.5 $4.5 million. He had, I believe, at the beginning of this transaction, before this transaction, had well over 100 million shares. So this was somewhere around a quarter of what I believe he had. And again, this is part of some alphanumeric combination, a 10B5-1 stock trading plan. So not a surprise to be expected. And he has a huge amount of his compensation over the course of his employment with WWE has been in the form of stock. So not surprising to see him sell some off now. He has done some transactions to cover tax expenses, but I think this is the first time he's really done a more of a straightforward sale.
This August marks 5 years Nick Khan has been with WWE.
Yeah, it does.
Maybe we'll do the look back on those 5 years. It's been a quiet 5 years, to be honest. Very little to talk about in terms of WWE's movement since 2020. Let's end off with ratings notes. So we'll go back to SmackDown on Friday, which won the night in the demo. 1,383,000 viewers. And they beat everything on cable and network with a 0.34, which is amazing. There was no NBA or NHL competition, so that was the key to them winning the night. So, yes, they edged out Shark Tank and 2020 and the College Softball World Series while ranking 8th on Netflix in Canada and Bolivia, which if you're looking for the wild card for I'm not as concerned about NXT Europe. I want to know when NXT Bolivia is coming, okay? Because this is the most consistent international player that they've got. Bolivia shows up for anything WWE related.
Well, I think we're seeing a lot of South American countries because they're in the right time zone to watch it live, maybe.
Not SmackDown. They have better things to do. Not Bolivia. Here, Canadians and Bolivians, we have nothing else to do on Friday nights. Give us 8 hours of SmackDown. We'll watch it, apparently. So there you go. That was SmackDown Friday. They will go up against the NHL this coming Friday, the Stanley Cup Final. Do you have a preference between the Oilers and the Panthers?
Well, I'll go with the city that actually has ice and snow. So
Edmonton
Let's see if there can be a Canadian winner to the Stanley Cup this year.
Collision on Saturday, 504,000 viewers and a 0.18. Have they turned the corner?
Pretty good. It's all turning around now. Glad to see it and that they finally come back, and this will be the sustained level from here on out.
Was this a direct result of the Lucha influence on this particular edition of Collision? Was this the El Paso crowd? What do you think led to this this big boost?
Well, I do know one thing. This is a huge disappointment for Inside the NBA on TNT, which had its last show. No wonder it had its last show. They had a lead-in. Inside the NBA had a huge lead-in from the Knicks and Pacers game, 6.9 million viewers. Inside the NBA was only able to hold on to less than half, only 3 million viewers for Inside the NBA. So a big disappointment for them. No wonder they're not being renewed.
Is Shaq a draw?
He used the F-word, though, on this broadcast.
Free agent?
Different F-word.
Oh. Well, that's not good. Or maybe it is. AEW broke down barriers at WBD. When it comes to language,
it was pretty late, and he did because it's the last show. I'm going to say it, so he said the F word.
Good for him.
Yeah,
Raw
lead in here. So
yes, that's huge lead in, and yes, no Collision this weekend because it's the extra 2 hours is being tacked on tonight, as it will next week as well. And then the latest Raw number. So folks, Brandon's going to take over this. So this is the Monday, May 26th number that Raw did on Netflix, 2.6 million views, which would be their lowest to date on Netflix, still ranking sixth globally.
It's tied for the lowest. I guess if we're including watch time, right, it would be lower than the other 2.6 million, which was the 24th, where they did 5.5 million hours viewed, which is, substantially higher than 4.8 million.
And so it was sixth globally, fourth in the U.S., fifth in Canada, also ranking in India and the U.K. among the 15 countries it was ranked in the top 10. Do you want to go through any of the methodology, Brandon? Do you want to take us through any of this? This is becoming
not really
the ultimate hot button issue when it comes to pro wrestling discourse.
I understand there's some controversy on how to interpret these numbers. Are you familiar with such controversy?
No, not at all.
No. I've been in conversation once again with Dave Meltzer, who views these numbers differently. And my understanding now of and he's been reporting it this way, right, is that he believes that at least the U.S. number is way down, and he's skeptical that these Netflix numbers have not been changed, at least over time, or they're calculating them in ways that are not truly transparent. So what I think he believes, what I understand he believes, and talk to him directly, is that he thinks that the only way that this, in the case of this most recent number for the May 26th show, the only way that this 2.6 million global views works out would be if you assumed that only 15% of the viewing audience over 7 days was actually live and the rest of it was 85%, which doesn't make a lot of sense, right? Can you imagine that only 15% of the global audience who was watching Raw were actually watching it live? That seems hard to believe, right? And in fact, I can tell you that it's about 55%, or at least it was earlier this year. It's about 55% are watching live. So on its face, that makes sense that, well, it could only work out, the 2.6 million global views could only work out if it was 1585. But 1585 isn't plausible. I agree with that. But the issue is that there are not just two durations, but there are actually three durations, at least according to Netflix. This is something that they told WrestleNomics on the record back in February, that what you're seeing on the screen here is how it's calculated. Basically, they have four different durations for Raw, which is why we see on the big chart itself that comes out every week, we see that, for example, the most recent episode that we have data for, again, May 26th, had a duration of 1 hour and 43 minutes. Now, of course, when it aired live, it was more like 2.5 hours. But if you, theorize, you just put some arbitrary inputs in here and say, okay, there's four durations, not two. And you say, well, there's this one duration that we know is, if you look at it on Netflix on the interface right now, it is hour 43 minutes. So we put that in for, let's call that the final. And then let's say we know that the live broadcast was 2.5 hours. And then let's pick some numbers here about what the other two durations could have been. Let's say it's 2 hours and the other one's an hour 55. And then we can plug in, 55% live, let's say 15% an hour 43, 10% 2 hours, 20% an hour 55. And then we do get an end result that matches what they're reporting in the chart if we calculate it that way. So I think it works out. Seems to make sense. It's not easy to understand or very clear. But Netflix did explain it to me last February, and if you plug in some arbitrary inputs, you can make sense and you can reconcile the math.
And that concludes the fun portion of Pollock and Thurston. So take that, ChatGPT.
Get it?
I think charts always make things a lot more digestible. And Brandon, you're on top of it. So I think that this is the new math that
That's a bunch of methodology, but what does this actually mean for how is Raw doing compared to?
Are they opting out after 5 years with WWE? That's the answer, Brandon, that everyone wants.
So in my estimates of the U.S. viewership, I'm just taking the decline from the first episode, which we do have a U.S. number from, and comparing that to the global number, which, of course, we do have a number from for every episode. And I'm just deducing that it's declined to the same degree in the U.S. as it has in globally. And what we get if we use that assumption is it did about 1.5 million viewers, which is slightly down from the same week of the year prior.
All right. Next week, we're going to try and track down Bella Bajaria. She's going to come on and chat with us about all of this. So yes, They'll be hearing from us over this.
She's not available. Maybe we can get Ted on.
Sure. I'll go with Ted. We'll take Ted.
Or maybe Greg. Greg doesn't do very many public appearances, though, I understand.
Yeah. Or Mark could join us right after he gets to watch Worlds Collide.
I'm sure he'll be watching either way.
He's looking forward to it. All right. That's going to wrap up the show. Tonight, I'm back at midnight Eastern with Wei Ting. This is going to be a long night, folks. After 4 hours of wrestling, what could be more fun than listening to the two of us exhausted after 4 hours talking about 4 hours of wrestling? That's tonight on Rewind to Dynamite. We go live at postwrestlingcafe.com, where you can check out all of our extra shows. We will be putting out our mailbag show on Thursday, going through all of your questions from the past month. And Brandon, what is happening over at WrestleNomics and where can people follow all of your work, including the latest in Netflix data?
All of my reports for all of the wrestling shows, all the big weekly WWE and AEW wrestling shows are always at patreon.com/WrestleNomics and on WrestleNomics.substack.com. Same content on either, same price, either one you want. All of that is there. I'm reworking how I do my weekly Friday reports that are called the State of the Business. We'll have some new information in there this week too.
All right. Check out all of that. And we're going to end off with some words of wisdom from one of your elected leaders. Okay. Sometimes people are a little bit too glass half empty. Sometimes you need those uplifting messages from the people that you vote for that represent you, the citizens. So I thought we'd leave with a more of a positive message to end this week's edition of Pollock and Thurston. We'll chat with you next week.
Well, we all are going to die.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.